You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And we are joined today by two guests to speak about the whole issue of trans rights in Singapore. Basically, trans rights in Singapore are under attack. Emboldened by the successes in Florida and Uganda, organized Christo fascists are ruthlessly pathologizing and criminalizing trans individuals worldwide. And in the case of Singapore, this means amending the Mental Health Care and Treatment Act to forcefully institute people for being transgender. Now, we're joined by Carissa, who is a community organizer and political theorist, who is also happens to be one of the main targets by a number of far-right actors in Singapore. And then we're also joined here by Joyce, who is an engineer who is concerned about big tech, data security, and cyber warfare. And of course, they've both been involved in this in an ongoing campaign for trans rights in Singapore. Good morning, both. Good morning, Joyce and Cara.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us. Yes.
To start off, what can you tell us, I guess, about the attacks on trans rights in Singapore, and also, I guess, the background to, you know, I mentioned from your campaign material, you know, this background to the amendment to the Mental Health Care and Treatment Act, which in a sense could play a role in forcibly institutionalizing people for being transgender.
Where do I begin? We have, since last year, we have been fighting against the Christian far right. We've discovered that a certain far right actor who, you know, has been persistently harassing, stalking, and doing a whole bunch of things, had sought assistance of the Christian far right, claiming that they are an ex-trans person, that they are detransitioning, and that we are a cabal of LGBTQ people who are trying to persecute them and trying to retaliate against them, and accuse them of crimes just because they are detransitioning. Of course, all of this isn't true. They have committed a whole bunch of crimes on their own accord, and they're now using this as an excuse, you know, to get away for all of this. So, of course, the Christian far right themselves, they don't necessarily believe what this actor, Mercury Jamie Ellis, says. But, it's a story, it's one of those narratives that, they are not just willing to pass on, right? They are basically just taking it and running with it. So, yeah, Carrie, got anything to add on?
Of course, I think this is where we get to the background a bit about certain matters regarding how the Christian far right got to the point where it is today, the amount of strength that it has today. And to preface that, I just want to say that Christianity and Christian politics in Singapore has not always started out fundamentalist and far right, but this is a much more recent phenomenon. By recent, we mean in the past about 20, 30 years or so. Singapore's history dates back a lot longer than that. And in fact, we have got a very long history, in fact, of non-far right, for that matter, non-right-wing forms of Christianity and Christian politics in Singapore. And this actually has to, we have to look back at the originating event of 1987, known as Operation Spectrum, actually, which was carried out by Singapore's Internal Security Department. And as a result of that, which actually resulted in a series of detentions of about more than 10 social activists from certain Catholic social groups and stuff like that, that had actually resulted on the basis that the government was claiming that these people were engaged in a Marxist conspiracy to take over the state in Singapore, right? So the result of that, the consequence of Operation Spectrum, was that the politics of like religious politics in Singapore, and in particular with Christianity and Catholicism, has shifted dramatically towards the right, and especially towards the far right, because the signal that was sent from Operation Spectrum is that anything deemed as on the left or too left-wing, even though a lot of those activists were basically moderate progressives, they were not actually even particularly radical in their politics, but that got them detained. So the message that was sent loud and clear, even if the government had not intended for it, was basically, if you swing that direction instead, you're gonna get, be at risk of being detained. You are gonna be at risk of crossing the red line, the literal red line, right? So what we end up with over the next 30 years, and along around that time, we also had basically 1985 financial crisis in Singapore, which is Singapore's first post-independence financial crisis, which kind of led to the government essentially after that, and after the 1997 and 1998 Asian financial crisis around the region, the narrative that the Singapore government took away is, well, I guess we have weathered this storm. We have generally weathered this crisis better than most of our regional neighbors. So let we have the confidence to kind of change the economy in certain ways, rewrite the rules of the economy, deregulate the banking and finance sector to attract all kinds of money into Singapore, which comes at its own set of costs, right? So when you have that, what you have is a couple of confluence of factors where Christianity in Singapore in particular has at that time become more affluent and therefore a lot more middle and upper class rather than its original working class origins in the Singapore context. And that also shifts its politics a lot towards a much more right-wing kind of politics, which is also influenced further by American dark money funding, essentially, which started around that time with you have many organizations in the US actually. In fact, Open Democracy documents this $280 million dollars in funding across by 28 organizations across five continents in the world, right, in dark money. And this is only by the 28 largest organizations, like largest Christian fellow organizations in the US. And Singapore is definitely no exception because around then, 1980, you definitely see the presidency of Ronald Reagan. And after that, you see a lot of the whole moral majority kind of narrative happen in the US. And that was really starting to get again a foothold in South Korea, in Singapore. And that was really where the birth of the Christian far right in Singapore came about. And that led to another pivotal event where you see in 2009, where actually Singapore's leading feminist organization and like gender equality organization known as AWARE was almost taken over, almost successfully taken over by a group of Christian far-right leaders from the Church of Our Savior. In 2009, this was called the AWARE saga. And it was only until you had hundreds of people show up to basically block that takeover after they had successfully taken over that the coup attempt basically managed to be stopped within the AWARE organization in Singapore. So that was one of the high water marks at that time where the Christian fight really demonstrated their strengths and showed that they were not afraid to essentially take over even our civil society organizations so that they can impose their agenda and so that they can push back on certain things. Which then now leads us to the basically what happens in the next decade, right? Because in 2011, essentially, Singapore had a general election, which if you look at it in any other country, that would otherwise be seen as a non-event, right? Singapore's ruling party lost five additional seats in the general election. That was essentially, in any other country, that would be a landslide victory, right? But in the Singapore context, it was seen as a watershed election. And this came on the backs of essentially the global financial crisis, 2008, 2009. You have millions of people around the world whose entire retirement savings accounts were basically wiped out, right? And in Singapore, a lot of questions after that were being raised about where has that money gone for a lot of ordinary working class Singaporeans, especially in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, in the aftermath of a lot of the financialization that came after Singapore decided, hey, let's deregulate the banking sector after the Asian financial crisis, right? So that led to you had a number of people who were raising a lot of questions in that area when it came to the financial state of Singapore, and in particular when we talked about retirement savings. When it came to, because Singapore has a compulsory retirement savings scheme known as the Central Provident Fund, which then led to another development in 2012, 2013, which is basically the in, again this goes back to the Internal Security Department. So a lot of the developments we see today actually boil down to one very simple fact, which is that if you look at Singapore, I mean Singapore is the subject of a lot of difference in opinion on many matters of governance today because of its different distinct characteristics compared to most nation states. But that's not really what we're looking at. We're not really looking at opinions about Singapore because people have all kinds of opinions about Singapore. But what we're going to look at is three material facts about contemporary Singapore that nobody can dispute. First of all, Singapore has a very small land area, very small total land area compared to most countries, definitely a lot smaller than Australia. Secondly, Singapore has a very high population density in this residing in this very small land area. And thirdly, compared to most countries in the world, Singapore is highly governable. And the consequence of this is that because Singapore's institutions, public institutions, have a lot more institutional capacity to govern, that also means that whatever decisions it does make has much more significant repercussions at a much faster rate. And in the context of Singapore, right, these three material facts about contemporary Singapore inform the much closer coupling in Singapore between national security policy and political economic policy in terms of navigating how to best govern Singapore. And in the context of Singapore, again, small independent sovereign states like Singapore do not last all that long in the world. You don't see a lot of other countries like Singapore for very obvious reasons, and especially not with our location, if we are not adequately defended both against internal and external threats to our national security. And Singapore's location makes this even more crucial because you have many other great powers, you have many other foreign influences that are want to come, or that have their own vested interests in wanting to stick a finger into the pie, because Singapore's a very attractive location for many countries, obviously, right? So that creates a situation whereby that it is going to be very challenging for any government, much more the Singapore government, to find a sustainable balance between our domestic political economy and structuring that and positioning that within the regional and global political economy, and figuring out how at the same time to defend and uphold our national security, right? So when these choices obviously at some point result in there are some strains in these choices, there is some the balance is strained at some level, you are going to run into a situation where people will notice the problems that result from the gov from governance not always getting it right. And some people are going to speak up about it, such as with the matter of retirement savings, such as with the matter of various other things. And when that happens, the Singapore state essentially is presented with two answers to this problem. Either you can choose to fix the real problems underlying it, or you can choose to fix up the people who are exposing these problems by treating the people as the real problems instead. And essentially, this is the background of the current situation, dating all the way back from 1987, dating all the way back from 2013, and laying essentially the backstory behind how we have come to a point where you have one individual known as Mercury Jamie Ellis, who is a serial far-right adversary, assisted by multiple other far-right actors, both within the state, such as within the Internal Security Department, as well as within non-state actors, such as the Christian far-right within certain mega churches in Singapore. And that is actually how we get to the point where we are in Singapore today, where Singapore, a country that's reputed for our law and order reputation, for our stability, our political stability, for our economic success, is at a crossroads where we find that we are not so sure if we know how to deal with any of this at all.
Well, I guess that you've kind of gone in, you've kind of given, I guess, a bit of the kind of the whole kind of background to this kind of the attacks on trans rights in Singapore. You also kind of went a bit more in, went into, I guess, the next question I was going to ask, which is, I guess, talking a bit more about the role, I guess, of the Christian far right. But I guess my understanding is in terms of the Christian far right within Singapore. You're saying there's been this, this deliberate attempt to persecute, victims of these of the trans rights. And I guess I want to kind of hear, potentially if Harvey wants to kind of speak about that, what is the sort of background to this sort of persecution by the Christian far right?
I guess I will share a bit about this, given that Harvey has also requested for that. So essentially, the background in Singapore is that I think after what I've mentioned, right, the Singapore Christian far right has been active for many years in trying to basically push for certain legislative changes, push for certain regulatory changes, to basically push certain agendas against things like comprehensive sex education, against things like gender equality, and especially against things like queer and trans rights. In Singapore, queer and trans access to resources, queer and trans access to housing, healthcare, education, and all kinds of other things in Singapore, right? So that's something that actually has been ongoing for years. But what changed, especially when it came to where when you come to the introduction of an actor like Mercury Jamie Ellis, is that the Christian far right finds someone that they are able to use essentially as the centerpiece, as the pivot to their campaign, to basically suggest that queer and trans people are dangerous, queer and trans people are actively persecuting this one person who's supposedly trying to detransition and is now claiming to be persecuted by a bunch of, as they will put it, gender extremists, gender ideology extremists, right? And that is what gives them the impetus to want to try to plot a range of subsidiary operations under this larger umbrella of Operation High Tide. Basically, as of this is and to put it in no unclear terms, this is essentially a foreign influence operation. And in the Singapore context, I mentioned globally, you're talking about 280 million. In Singapore, this is easily 200,000 a year coming through various organizations. And this is something we've actually come to learn about some of the details of this along the way, because we have, I mean, Mercury themselves has been receiving a lot of this information via the relevant actors, because Mercury has been used by them essentially as a fixer, as essentially someone that is assigned to basically carry out certain attacks on behalf of the Christian far right, on top of the attacks that Mercury has already been carrying out for their own purposes. For example, the murder of one of our friend's grandfathers, actually, for the purpose of trying to get that friend pinned and falsely accused of murder, right? So this is actually one in a series of many fix-up operations that the Christian far right has attempted for the purpose of trying to paint the victims of Mercury as essentially dangerous queer and trans people, and so as to justify pushing such a certain legislation to further restrict queer and trans people's rights. And in particular, with the one you mentioned earlier regarding the Mental Health Care and Treatment Act, and actually this was covered in a public letter that I released on the 1st of May this year, during May Day this year, to the which I wrote to the President of Singapore at that time, basically Madam Halimah Yacob, where I've spelled out some of the details about that. But basically, the intent actually is basically to amend the Mental Health Care and Treatment Act so that trans people as a demographic, obviously, it will not be referred to as just transgender persons. It will be referred to as, say, persons diagnosed with gender dysphoria or something like that, you know, who are basically going to be targeted on the basis that they will be that such persons will be a danger to themselves or to others or to society, right? Because that's the basis for which the Mental Health Care and Treatment Act, which itself is an unjust legislation, to be clear, is used to actually basically like justify certain kinds of detention, certain kinds of arrests of people of people on the basis of, well, mental health concerns. On the basis that they may be a danger to themselves and others, and to justify essentially holding them within some form of custody until some form of supervision within an approved or designated mental health institution in Singapore until they are deemed to be like fit for release, essentially. So that in the context of the Christian far right, in the context of trans people in Singapore, the objective they have is basically precisely to cause these trans people who come to be to who come to be detained under the Mental Health Care and Treatment Act to be placed under that kind of supervision until they detransition. That's kind of the objective. And you and along with that, they also have plans to basically put in place a registry of all the persons in Singapore who are either diagnosed with gender dysphoria who are suspected to have gender dysphoria in Singapore. So that actually comes into play there as well. So these are obviously things that if you hear them in any other context on their own, just the descriptions of them, they will sound alarming already. It doesn't help that the Christian far right in Singapore is not very subtle either, and they have a document that basically titles this quite literally and quite explicitly as the Christian solution to the transgender problem. I wonder when's the last time we heard something like this, and I wonder what happened as a result of that. Yes.
Well, before I go into kind of like the kind of last question I wanted to ask, which is a bit more about, you know, the broader campaign and, you know, what you want, you know, people who might be listening to this interview can do in terms of one, because I know you have a full you have a campaign page where you're encouraging people to send letters to the Singapore consulate. But I guess that's all one. I have one question that I think would be a bit of interest to our listeners, especially in Australia, is I guess I want to kind of hear some of your perspectives on, because I guess just an observation to make, in the context of Australia, where I'm from, it is very clear that the far right are using transphobia as a kind of central issue by which they are organizing. And I guess I want to hear your comments, I guess, on some of the like the kind of international trends about the far right and their attacks on trans rights. And of course, you mentioned also well that I mean these you know this attempt is also linked to organizations in America who are attempting to influence public policy and legislation in Singapore.
I mean, I will start with that, and I'll pass the mic to Joyce because I think she has a lot of experience in this area that I can share as well. But what I want to say first and foremost is that the attack specifically on the trans community and trans rights is merely the tip of the spear. It is very much at the tip of the spear, because when you talk about far right actors, and in particular the Christian far right, but in general other far right groups as well, for example the alt-right, for example other kinds of secular far right groups, for example other kinds of religious far right groups, what you essentially have is trans people are treated as a wedge issue. They're treated as the first community to be targeted because they are treated as the ones that essentially have there is no numer the numerical minority is so insignificant, perceived to be so insignificant, that they can get away with doing that electorally, they can get away with doing that politically and not face a lot of backlash. That is the assumption we have. We are not going to let that happen for very obvious reasons, right? But what comes after that, when we talk about fascism, when we talk about fundamentalists, when we talk about far-right actors, it never stops at one marginalized community. It will move on to the next. There will always be a next group, there will always be a next demographic, and at some point it will move on to the broader working class masses in Singapore and in other countries. This is not a Singapore issue only. This is not a trans or queer issue only. This is a global issue, and this is an issue that will target essentially the rights of everyone. You look at you just look at the US with Roe versus Wade and all the and the anti-abortion laws that are trying that have been attempted to be passed in various different states. You know, you see in Ohio, in fact, they managed to finally pass a bill that blocks off the anti-abortion regulations, and the conservatives, the Christian far right there, is pushing back against that. They are trying to say, oh no, that referendum, the results of that referendum weren't legitimate, which is very similar to what they did in 2020 with the elections there. So you're seeing a lot of these efforts being pushed back already, because the issue goes a lot further than just trans rights. The issue goes a lot further into fundamental matters of stuff like, say, reproductive rights, stuff like, say, access to material rights in other areas for all kinds of groups. And in the US context, you talk about that, but that comes in the context of race as well. That comes in the context of class as well. In Singapore, that is no different than the Christian far right in Singapore, in particular, compared to the US. The US has a much more class diverse Christian far right. Singapore's Christian far right is a lot more heavily upper class. That also comes with its own set of priorities, it also comes with its own set of agendas, which is very different from what you see even in the US, although it has basically copied wholesale many of the policy priorities of the US, many of the talking points in the US, right? So that's actually what is going on right now. And I would say that in Singapore, we face a very dangerous push whereby, like I said, because we're a lot smaller, we're a lot more governable. In the US, if you want to try to actually implement something on the ground, it's not going to be very easy for you to uniformly implement it across the whole country. You're going to have differences. You're going to have difficulties implementing certain, operationalizing certain things simply because of the large size. Certain things you're just not going to be able to execute in that way. In Singapore, you don't have that challenge. It's a lot faster. The reverberations are a lot faster. The repercussions are a lot faster in Singapore.
All right. Well, thanks for that. I guess I want to go into the kind of last kind of question, and then following your answer, I'll also promote the upcoming rally for our listeners that's happening in Melbourne. How can I know you have a website which is, I think is called Safety for Singapore. Can you tell us about the website and I guess the call to action and also how people can stand in solidarity with the trans community in Singapore? And how we can oppose this what's happening.
I was shipping here by first saying that the website is actually I actually want to give a shout out to actually our international comrades in different parts of the world who have helped us to put together a website, because as you can see clearly, a lot of us have been fighting this situation on a very day-to-day basis, which is why I keep telling people I am not involved in this in my in any activist capacity, definitely not in my capacity as an organizer in the work I've done in various areas before related to this, but I'm very much involved in this as an ordinary citizen, as an ordinary individual who's being targeted with by various far-right actors and having to basically this is basically a matter of life and death for many of us. So there's a lot of work we have been doing, and so essentially again I want to reiterate I'm very thankful for the efforts that many different people around the world have shown solidarity to us, many comrades around the world have shown solidarity to us in this process, in the other international actions, through coming up with resources, coming up with materials to help this to help other people understand this situation a lot more easily. So Safety for Singapore is one of the one such website which has tried to condense the very complex story behind this matter, really, and I think that has been very useful. So I think within the website, actually, if you read a lot of what's going on there, you will get somewhat more detailed backstory about some of the matters, some of the and why these are relevant to people around the world as well, why these have implications, not just for the victims of Mercury, not just for the queer and trans people in Singapore, not just for the broader population of Singapore, but for the region and for the world at large, really, I think. So I think that's really well also something I just want to preface and say first. But at this juncture, Joyce, if you have anything to add on, please go feel free to take the mic from me.
I mean the site is just pretty much Like it is quite in depth, and this is a really complicated story because on one hand you have the Christian far right, as I've said before. On the other hand, you have the you have the Internal Security Department as well as certain parts of Singapore State, who realized that hey, they could use a single actor, Mercury Jamie Ellis, to basically target and silence their political opponents from speaking out. One of these matters is the Central Provident Fund, which is Singapore's mandatory retirement savings scheme. So after Budget 2012, opposition politician known as Kenneth Jeyaretnam noticed that there were discrepancies in the data provided by the government, and we started asking questions about Singapore's financial reserves as well as the amount of funds and monies in the Central Provident Fund. This was a very sensitive topic for the Singapore government, and this is where Harvey gets involved. They realize that Harvey had connections to Kenneth Jeyaretnam's son online, and what they did is that they decided that look, if we can get Harvey to testify falsely against Kenneth Jeyaretnam, we can diminish his credibility as a person, and things like that. So what they did was that they set Harvey up for bomb hoax she did not commit. And when she was facing interrogation for that false bomb hoax, the Internal Security Department stepped in and said, hey, we need to testify against Kenneth Jeyaretnam. Harvey refused. And since then, the internal sec like she has been considered a threat by the Internal Security Department. So yeah, point is, you got two different actors who, like the Christian far right and the Singapore State, who realize that, who find that, hey, you have one Mercury Jamie Ellis because of their proximity to Harvey, that Mercury could be used, to target Harvey and, things like that. So the site itself documents all of that. Unfortunately, this is a very long and very complex situation. So I encourage people to actually, look at the site itself. And to end it off from me, like I say that the way to show solidarity, for us, of course, is for the people who can, please attend the rally. My hope is that people would, who are the people who have who are able to, that they can spend time, learning about, Singapore's history and understanding, some of Singapore, like some of the politics and some of the affairs surrounding Singapore. Because, all of this, as Carrie has said before, earlier, all of this is tied. What happens in Singapore because of its position in the world and, not just as a trading hub, but as a financial and tech hub as well. What happens in Singapore affects Southeast Asia regionally and the rest of the world. So yes, a bet like for anyone on the left, having a better understanding of Singapore would be like would help not just us, but it also helps with an understanding of, how Singapore ties into the rest of the world. Singapore is also complicit in things like what's going on in Myanmar right now, what's happening with Israel and Palestine right now because of Singapore's relations to Israel as well. So, yeah.
Well, thank you very much for this interview. I think it's very good. Just a reminder to our listeners, there'll be a rally organised around this whole issue in Melbourne. Titled Say No to Trans Genocide Funded by Christo-Fascists in Singapore. And that's going to be happening at 4 p.m. at the State Library this Sunday. But yeah, I hope listeners enjoy. You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And I'd also like to thank our guests, Joyce and Carissa, for joining us on the program today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.